This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about fertility as a factor in mental health with two wonderful fellow podcasters who each have distinct insight into this topic that I'm so glad we're covering. First off, Dr. Kibbe McMahon is a clinical psychologist and yogi who met Jacqueline through their studies at Duke University. And Jacqueline is a PhD student, soon to be clinical psychologist, and a member of Bachelor Nation, i.e. having appeared on both The Bachelor and The Bachelor in Paradise, if you watch either of those TV shows. And together they teamed up in 2020, at a time when people really needed it, to create a podcast called A Little Help From Our Friends. It sheds light on some of the issues your loved ones could be struggling with and provides scientifically informed perspectives on various mental health topics, including today's topic, fertility, gaslighting, and the experience of veterans, just to give a few examples. And knowing just how many of our listeners listen specifically with the intent of better understanding how to support people close to them, that itself gives me so much hope that we're continuing to head in the right direction in terms of stigma. And then on top of that, a show like this popping up that I think is so brilliant and I genuinely love so much, that is all around that intent of how can you better understand and better support alongside that is really wonderful. It gives me a lot of hope. And that's all I'm going to say about our guests for now. You'll learn a lot more about them in the episode, and I learned so much from them during this conversation. So for now, I'm going to keep brief. I'm currently away in Edinburgh working at the Fringe Festival 6 days a week. So it's been quite full on. I'm sort of pushing back against the burnout as best I can, you know, trying to get naps in where I can, trying to be extra streamlined with a lot of my work. That did mean, unfortunately, we had a reschedule with one of our episode recordings, and hence how you got a re-release last week, because there was no time to organize to get in a different guest, or indeed to interview the guest, even if I had organized that. Anyway, it is one of my favourite episodes you got last week, so I was glad to give it a second time in the spotlight. And this one, I can already tell, certainly two of my favourite guests. And I think when I listen back, maybe indeed one of my favourite apps as well. One last quick thing to mention. Thank you to all of you that voted for us in the podcast awards. The shortlist has recently been released, and for the fifth year in a row, we are in the top 10 shortlist. At the end of September, we find out if we won. So keeping everything crossed till then, we will keep you posted. In addition to my peers that are judges, other podcasters, a select number of listeners that voted in the first round are also invited to vote again. And that includes, as it turns out, my friend Jack, who you'll know from if you listen to my other podcast, Dating Games. And so if you do get that email asking you to vote in this round, please do. You don't even have to vote for us. Hopefully you will, but that's a chance to contribute to the awards and winners across the board. And so, yeah, with that all said, we'll get into this episode with Kibbe and Jacqueline in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Kibbe McMahon. My early experience with mental health, I feel like it's been a big part of my life, all my life. But where it probably started was when my parents divorced when I was six, and my mom became a single mom, you know, away from her family. She's originally from Hong Kong, and it was really hard for her. And so she struggled with depression, a lot of rage, and alcoholism. That led to a really chaotic upbringing, a lot of fights, a lot of shifting moods, just nothing was predictable. Nothing felt safe or, you know, routine. So that led me to kind of grab on to anything I could that was more safe. So I really got obsessive about school and being self-reliant, like not relying on my mom for a lot of things and relying on myself. And that led to, you know, all sorts of stuff for me, like anxiety, depression, anger with myself, ups and downs with the relationships, because my friends and teachers and everyone became like my stronghold. So yeah, that's probably the beginning of it. It was a long stretch of time until I moved out and have been working on it ever since and gotten to a good place now of understanding. But yeah, it was a lot of hardship for several years.
For sure. And I relate to a lot of that, but there's something there that I hadn't thought about quite in that way before in terms of the pressure it can put on those friendships when they're, mm-hmm. you know, partly making up for gaps in connection you might be having elsewhere. And then, you know, any turbulence you're experiencing then gets exacerbated by, okay, well, how are things going with all my friendships? Because I need something to be stable, or whether it's putting so much into your work, and then that's great as long as mm-hmm. it stays stable.
That's probably why I'm obsessive about work. I'm very career oriented all my life, but also really interested in relationships, empathy, connection, all the stuff that we talk about in our work with mental health, because it's something that wasn't a given for me. It was something that I had to forge and something that I had to really cling on to. So my friends are my family now, and I've had many years where any kind of breakups, any kind of friendship mishaps drifting away was really destabilizing for me. So yeah,
and it's good that you found really good friends over the years, because that makes such a difference. And there is something kind of bittersweet, you know, there's pros and cons there to the friends of family piece, that it can be so wonderfully uplifting to find chosen family that can kind of, you know, hold you and create a sense of like safety and community for you, but then also you're reminded of it being conditional at times.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very common in mental health, where your parents are the only people who are supposed to be the ones who love you unconditionally, right? Like through, you know, basically like tantrums and ups and downs and everything. And then if you don't have that unconditional love, you look for it in your romantic relationships or friendships. And it's just like inappropriate at that point, right? If you hurt someone, they're going to leave you and they should. But that could be really upsetting for some people, because they're trying to look for something that was like their one chance that they missed as a child. And you just have to grieve it instead of trying to replace it.
Yes. And like many things, I'm not hugely kind of into binary thinking. And I think this goes along with like the idea of conditional or unconditional love, because you're right, I don't think it should be unconditional. That maybe the love that we're encouraged to expect from a parent should be less conditional and, you know, harder to break in certain ways. But no, we should still be kept accountable. And I couldn't help but being slightly distracted by Jacqueline's cat, because I'm away from home right now and I'm missing mine. And that is part of the reason why I like cats, because a cat's love, I trust, because they'll let you know if they don't like you. Whereas a dog that seems to love everyone, I feel like if I owned a dog, I'd be like, what are you doing? Giving your love and your warmest welcome to everybody that comes to the door.
100%.
And Jacqueline, could you share a bit about, you know, where things started for you with your mental health experiences?
Sure. I'll also just say that in my last relationship, I was called the cat in the relationship and he was the dog. And that was kind of used as a way to call me like cold. But actually, I just think I'm, I have my own way of loving, which I prefer. I prefer cats.
You know what you like and you allowed him into your life. And that's a compliment. Yeah.
Yeah. My early experience. So my mom is a psychiatrist. So mental health was always a topic in our household, and all of my siblings sort of suffered from one thing or another. I was mostly dealing with depression kind of on and off for about 10 years with two like really strong points. So when I was 14, there's a lot of teenage angst, a lot of loneliness and wondering where I fit in socially and just hating everything about myself. And you know, just not really being able to cope with changes in friendships. You know, early teenage friendships can be pretty mean and catty and competitive. And I just remember that really, really brought me down until I basically lost a bunch of friends, and then I replaced them with good friends who were much more supportive. And my family was quite competitive, and so career was always a big thing, you know, like how much money do you make, how much, and that's not something my parents instilled in me, but I remember being very kind of focused on like how much money I was going to make, how much prestige I was going to have. And I just couldn't figure out what I wanted to be. So I went into the wrong career. And I was in it very briefly because I just realized that if I spent 9 hours a day answering questions I didn't care about, then life was, it was only going to be worth living for the hours between 6 and midnight. And that I was going to look back and think, wow, I wasted my life answering the wrong questions, like questions I don't care about, and spending my time doing something that makes me brain dead. And that was very, very scary to me because I didn't feel like I had the competence to thrive or to really succeed. And I had no idea what to do instead. And I became very, very depressed. And I found kind of inspiration in that depression because I was thinking about it all the time. So I figured, this is something that at least interests me, is depression. And I started all over. I moved home. I took college classes again and decided to be a psychologist, which was something I had kind of written off because my mom was a psychiatrist. And I felt like a psychologist was like the beta version of psychiatry, even though my mom was like, what are you talking about? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And now, of course, I'm thrilled to be here and I no longer hold that belief.
Mm-hmm. What was that like, both studying around mental health and then also experiencing your own symptoms at the time?
You know, as soon as I decided to go into psychology, my symptoms cleared and I haven't been depressed since. I've dealt with some anxiety for sure, but depression has never returned. And that's been really cool. But I lived in fear of it for a while. You know, I mean, I was really, really scared every single time I started a new job that it was going to return because I had it, you know, encircling that job. But it never did. I think doing something that I really believed in and was motivated in just changed everything.
No, that's so wonderful to hear. Yeah, I'm delighted for you. This is great.
Thank you.
And for you, Kibbe, growing up around depression, how much of that did you find relatable to you in whatever way that means?
Yeah, I think that it just, you know, when you have a really early experience with mental health, which, you know, a lot of people do, it just reminded me that, you know, the way we see the world and when the way we feel is, it just, our perspectives are not given. So it just, it taught me that I can approach school or any life, parents or anything so differently based on if I'm depressed or not depressed. It showed me like we all have a lens that we see our world through, and it's not all the same. So mental health meant so much because I was like, oh, wow, we really need to think about this and focus on it and help people who basically feel trapped in the way they see the world, right? Like if you see the world as rejecting, dangerous, hostile, then you're going to just see everything through that and it's going to affect you in the same way. You're going to like kind of attract and bring the same thing over and over and repeat these patterns. But so I guess what I'm saying is it highlighted to me like how important mental health is. And it's not something we should just take for granted and say, oh yeah, we just pick up by our bootstraps and life is great and everything like that. It's like, no, this is like, this can really affect everything, the way you see the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, there's that bittersweet thing of you learn so much from those experiences, even though they're not necessarily ones you would have chosen. And something that you both have a lot of insight into, as today's factor about mental health we're talking about, is infertility. Would either of you like to go first, sharing a bit of your experience on that?
I think Kibbe was first in time sequence. So
we're staying with the chronology. Yes, I love that. Yeah. You go ahead, Kibbe.
I've had a very interesting experience with infertility. It's very fresh in my mind and it's like very, very impactful in my life. So it's really on my mind a lot. I, you know, as I mentioned, I was very career oriented and never really thought about, I always wanted a family, always wanted children. So that kind of sets me apart from many people, but I took that for granted. I was just like, I'm going to work on my career and then I'll just have a family. I'll have kids one day. Mm-hmm. And then I started to try for a child with my now ex-husband a couple years ago. And it just wasn't working. Like, we just weren't able to get pregnant. And every month that it went by that it wasn't working, there's just this sinking feeling that something's wrong. But infertility is such a strange field in medicine right now because there really isn't that much research on it relative to other kinds of health. They don't know much about it. They don't know why some people get pregnant and some don't. They have some guesses, but it's a mystery for a large part. So they're just like, keep trying. You're healthy. Keep going. And it was probably one of the first times that I really, really wanted something. And no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get. It really doesn't lend itself to, like, you do the right things or work hard and you get it. It's like this miracle that people say, it's like, it's meant to be, or just relax and forget about it and it'll come to you. It's like, what does that, what do you mean?
I've heard that a lot. Yeah. And you hear those kind of parallels with dating. It's almost like if you look away, if you forget that you're trying to get pregnant, or you forget you're trying to get in a relationship.
You're like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's so frustrating, but you're also getting a lot of messages that there are things to do right and wrong. So it's a weird combination of you can control it, but it's also a miracle of life. So I was there for many months, and finally I went to doctors, and they couldn't tell me anything was wrong. All the tests and everything was fine. But then I started to move on to fertility treatments.
Before we go into that, actually, when it came to you realizing that, okay, we want to go see a doctor and see if we can find out if there is an issue here, what were those conversations like between you and your ex-husband?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, you know, is probably a big part of it, but our dynamic was not very good. We were on the surface fine, but underneath there was a lot of resentment because I felt like I was contributing more in the relationship than he was, in all different ways, practically, financially, and things like that. So it felt like it was all on me to do yet another thing for us. So he was really lighthearted about it, like, oh, we'll just keep trying, and oh yeah, we'll go to the doctor. And for me, it felt like, there's something wrong with me and I have to fix it. And I don't know what I have to do. And I felt very alone in it in many ways.
And was that your assumption straight away that it was something wrong with you specifically?
You know, eventually, actually, I started working with other women in a women's clinic who are also struggling with infertility. So I, on the other side, I got to talk to a lot of women who were also struggling with infertility as a therapist. But that's very common. When you go to a doctor, like a reproductive doctor, it's talking about the women. There's more research on why women can't get pregnant. Yeah, and I think that's the thing about motherhood. It's a lot more on the woman of if something goes right or wrong, it's on us. So yeah, there was a lot more conversation of what's wrong with me.
And there is a weird kind of nefarious blame game that can go on like that. You know, I was talking to a doctor friend only recently, and he was talking me through like this concept of sperm count. And how it's a very vague science in a way that it actually makes much less difference than you would think it would. And yet that's such a big part of the research around male fertility is how many swimmers you have, which, you know, you don't have to be a doctor to know. You only need one of them. So there's only ever so much that how many of them goes into it.
Yeah, it's a big mystery, but
I don't know. But if we think it could be the woman, well, we need to find that out. We need to pour the money into finding a reason why it's her fault.
Yeah. I don't know where it comes from. It's two people making a baby, but it's largely put on us of like what's right or wrong. We're the ones going to the doctors. You know, the men don't go, I mean, in my experience, men don't go to the fertility doctors without me, right? So, but I was often there, you know, going to the doctors by myself and getting the tests and getting, you know, scans and blood tests and all those things. And he just had one analysis and he was like, you're all good. So we'll focus on her and keep going. So,
I can understand further down the line, you know, when you have a pregnancy, that the focus is on you, of course. But in that early stage, it's two people.
Yeah.
And so you had these conversations. He was a bit more blasé about it. You had this sinking feeling that you say rightly is very common. And so they weren't able to find anything?
Nope, absolutely nothing. And it just became this, and that's a blessing, but also a curse, because
you want an answer, right? This is something that's very nice about getting a diagnosis mentally or physically or all the above. You know, there's someone says, ah, I understand your problem. We have a treatment for it. Mm-hmm. And they did not have that for me. And at the same time, I'm getting Instagram posts about everyone just getting pregnant. Oops, like the first time they tried. And, you know, so you start to feel more and more isolated and feel like something's wrong with you. And it's a very shaming thing. I've even had people tell me that it's because I was so career focused that that's why I'm not getting pregnant. So it's just, then I really first, you know, started to do fertility treatments because I was like, there's something wrong with me. I did 5 cycles of IUI, which is intrauterine injections, I think that's called. I forgot the act what it's termed for, but that's like first line of fertility treatments where they basically give me meds to ovulate, which made me very depressed. But I was just like, I'm going to do this. This is important to me. And then I started to move on to IVF. So went through 1 cycle of that and was days away from getting the embryo transferred into me when I had this gut feeling of this is wrong. I can't do this. My marriage is not healthy or not. I'm not in a place. And up until then, I did have some ambivalence about it, you know, just kind of like a fear of motherhood and fear of what this would look like and underlying fears of how this would look like in our marriage. And at that point, there was just some gut feeling of like, no, I can't, this is not right. And that led to my divorce. And that was really hard because I was 35 and going to think about starting over again. And then I did actually get together with someone new and we got pregnant almost right away. So naturally. So I am like 2 weeks away from my due date right now. So
oh, wow.
That's my journey.
I didn't even know that last part about it. Okay, that's so exciting. And also, yeah, and also funny that you did get that part of the miracle after all, that it happened when you didn't expect it then. I'm going to bring Jacqueline in at this point. So what was your experiences like? I saw you nodding a lot around the people making up their own reasons, people doing guesswork doctoring of maybe it's your career. Maybe that somehow affected your womb.
Yeah, I didn't have as rough a go as Kibby because I wasn't actively trying to get pregnant. I do know, you know, it was interesting when she was going through this, when you're a listener, you feel helpless as well because I understand the pull for, you know, for people to offer solutions or reasons because it's so hard to just sit there and say, I don't know. I'm so sorry. This is one of the most painful things a woman can go through and there's just no answer. I think that's really hard. And also she's conveyed to me how painful it was to have people offering, you know, reasons when it's like, there's nothing you can do with them. My situation was a friend of mine found out that she was premenopausal at the age of 29. So she had extremely diminished ovarian reserve. And so she was starting to encourage friends of hers to check into their fertility and freeze their eggs. And at the time, I was in a new relationship that was pretty rocky. This is with my ex-fiance. And I had been kind of a lifelong commitment phobe. And so but I knew I wanted kids. And so I was thinking, I don't know if I can trust this relationship. I don't know if I can trust myself to, you know, stay committed, but I definitely want kids. So I need to buy myself some time. And so I decided to freeze my eggs. And when I went in, I had a very, very high AMH, which is the hormone that corresponds with egg count. So I was going in thinking I'm like a fertility goddess. I'm a total rock star. This is going to be awesome. My mom had 4 kids. I was born at 40, you know, so I'm feeling good. And then I go in there and the doctor, her name is Dr. Amy. She's awesome. She was feeling good. And then she does the ultrasound and a cloud comes over her face and she turns to me and she says, okay, you have 6 follicles on 1 ovary, which is fairly low. And then the other one was just black. Like there was absolutely nothing. And she's like, I'm 98% sure you have endometriosis. That has covered, like completely covered your ovary. It's completely unproductive. So I now am faced with, you know, I freeze my eggs. I only get 4 eggs, which is very, very low. You know, it's a pretty low probability of getting a baby out of 4 eggs. And she directs me to go to a surgeon to make sure what this is and to get it out. But she's like, you're probably going to need to get pregnant sooner rather than later. At this point, my relationship with my ex-boyfriend had improved significantly and we were much more serious. And so this is one of the reasons, though, I think I was willing to rush that relationship is because I was getting this feedback, like, you're probably going to need kids now because if you do have endometriosis, you can get it removed, but it's going to come right back and then really damage your chances. And so he and I, you know, planned a wedding, decided to go for it. And then I go and get surgery and it turns out it was just a tumor. It's called a teratoma. Benign, it's fine. They removed it. And this whole story has a happy ending from the point of view of fertility because I went back, I froze my eggs again. I got 14 that time. So suddenly I'm back to kind of where I thought I should be. And I have these frozen eggs and everything is good. But it was very, very scary. And it made me realize, you know, women are just not directed to check into anything. And if they are, it's a blood test, which is what I had done. I learned I had high AMH. And based on that, I could have said, I'm not even going to try for kids until my late 30s. I'm good. But we don't get ultrasounds. You know, the tumor I had was painless. You know, I mean, there was no sign of it. But if I had waited any longer, you know, I could have lost the ovary. And so I just, you know, I was telling the story publicly on Instagram and, you know, definitely feeling things like I feel like a little bit less of a woman, less feminine. This was something that I just did not predict at all because it's not talked about. And it did rush a relationship that was ultimately unhealthy and that I ended at a critical point, kind of like Kibby did. So I don't know. I think fertility can be a huge roller coaster. It can be really unexpected. And I think women go in totally unprepared.
No, I think you're very right. And that contrast already of there's not the routine of checking in about fertility in many ways until there's concern. There's not the preemptive care that in so many things, including a lot of mental health care, we all try and advocate for, that we check in before things, before a clear problem is identified, ideally. And yet, if a problem is found, then still too often that is seen as some kind of reflection on you as a person, as a woman. You can feel it. You can feel it in the air, even if it's not said. There's that pressure. There's that expectation of you're female, so a child is an expectation hanging over you right from when you're born. And you have to want it and you have to be able to have it. Otherwise, what does that mean?
Yeah. I think women get asked much more often than men, like, when are you going to have a baby? And I've never minded that. But I do think it kind of embeds in us a sense that, you know, kids are part of our life cycle. The other thing I wanted to touch on that I agree with Kibby is when you do go into a career like ours, there is a sense that it would be impossible to have a kid while the training portion is still going on and that it would be so much easier to wait until all of that's over. But when all of that's over, you're in your mid-30s. And so a lot of women, I think, put off having kids and then they don't check into fertility because they don't know they need to. And then by the time they're 35 or older, it's already a geriatric pregnancy, quote, and their eggs are now lower quality and they're diminished in terms of number. So it just, it really, and there's this aspect of like, competing with men. And I think this is just a natural situation that we're in, right? I mean, I'm hoping it can be changed in some way, but men do have the luxury of waiting until they're in their late 30s or 40s to have kids. And it doesn't affect them really. Women, if we have babies in our early 30s, it really takes a hit to our careers. And so it makes it really hard to compete with the men in our field. And so I think a lot of women struggle with that decision.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's this whole concept of the woman that has it all. Mm-hmm. And that's directly competing. You know, you're expected to be able to both have a wonderful career. And if you're having a career that takes as many years of training as you have both gone through, that's particularly prized. And yet that's in direct competition with, okay, but then there's also the biological clock that can be so constraining. And for you, Kibby, could you share a bit about what those conversations were like to have? So you're really trying to get pregnant and everyone's giving their two cents or their theories.
Yeah, I think I'm fortunate that I do have a lot of friends and family who are supportive and empathetic. And I have a lot of psychologists, right, like Jacqueline included, who are in my world. So I appreciated that. I just found myself becoming so depressed. And it was a cycle of like, I was hopeful in the trying phase. And then when I found out that I wasn't pregnant, I was like horribly depressed for about 2 weeks. And then I try again. And I remember just like whatever they were saying, you know, I was frustrated with everyone's advice. So I found that in myself. I could see that people meant well, they were supportive. People did give advice a lot based on their own experience. They're like, you just need to relax. You just need to have a glass of wine and be in love. And I was like, what? What does that even mean? Am I in love with my marriage? I don't know. Like,
just, yes, I've definitely not tried relaxing.
Yeah, exactly. Just relax and don't think about it. I was thinking about it every minute of the day because it was, you know, you have to pee on sticks every day to test your ovulation. You're going to the doctor or you're measuring your temperature. It's like, it's always on the back of your mind when you're actively trying and having difficulty. And then to relax, I was like, well, that's easy for you because that's how it worked for you. So I was just like, but I couldn't be mad or mean to anybody because everyone was being really kind. And I really resented when people would tell me that it was because I'm just like so career oriented or you're too stressed out as a person. And I felt that really shamed me because that was the, you know, as I mentioned, that was my coping mechanism until that point, right? Like I got myself through life by being really hardworking and focusing on my career. And then people were telling me that's a huge flaw and that's why I can't give life. I mean, that really cut me to the core.
The same thing that would have been encouraged in so many ways only a few years before. And then it's like, oh, but what about kids? What about the timing? Yeah. Tick, tick, tick. Exactly. For some reason, everyone's watching you. Yeah.
Yeah. It really was like this pressure to be everything, you know, to be really, really good at work. And as Jacqueline's saying, compete in this really academic, competitive, male-dominated environment, but then also be a mother goddess. And you know, it felt impossible and I felt so inferior around that time.
Mm-hmm. And by contrast with your partner, what were the conversations he was having with you around this? And was he experiencing any pressure from the people in his life? I know the answer.
I really don't think so. Now, when it comes to fertility, yeah, I you know, it's interesting that you asked that because I actually don't know. And I think that gap in knowledge speaks volumes. I don't think he was talking to many people about it. I think he mentioned it to some people. That's how I seek support, is like reaching out to my friends and talking about my struggles. I don't think he was. And I don't think he saw that as a problem. I remember there's one conversation we had where it was like 6 months, you know, 6 month, 5 month of trying, the time where you're supposed to be able to get pregnant during that time. And I was like, I don't know why this is not working. I don't know how to get pregnant. And he was like, we just have to have more sex. And I just remember being furious because I'm just like, yeah, that's all you need to do, right? Like, he just needs to do that one thing and I need to do all the other things, the measuring, the doctors, the, you know, the stress, the blame, you know. And so it just felt so one-sided that I just don't think it only hit him until, you know, it only hit him when we started to get treatment. That was the first time he got upset that we weren't pregnant. And I was just like, well, I've been feeling that for the past 7 months. And that was the first time that he actually like was like, oh no, this is an issue. So yeah, wow. I just felt really alone. And I don't think we had a lot of conversations around it, or he had a lot of conversations around it, you know, which is in contrast to my experience. So
yeah, it's crazy how parallel your experiences can be in the same relationship, you know, how you can mm-hmm. be in those silos. And that he was able to brush it off in so many ways beforehand. That was, you know, that was his approach. And I can't help but wonder how much of that is, you know, that he didn't have the years of people asking if he was going to have a baby. He didn't have mm-hmm. these kind of biases in the conversations around whose fault it is. He didn't have mm-hmm. the, you know, question at a job interview of like, are you considering having a family at any point?
Yeah. And ironically, that might have been the thing that was the issue. I mean, I can't help. I mean, I have no idea why I got pregnant in this relationship versus not the last one, right? I'm totally speculating. But there was such an imbalance in terms of contribution and responsibility. And I felt like the weight was on me, the whole relationship, like career-wise, fertility, everything, it was all on me. And he was kind of like free to explore and do what he wanted. And then that just led to so much ambivalence and anger inside me that itself might have been the thing that prevented me from getting pregnant. I don't know, but mm-hmm. I feel very different in my current one, and it felt easy. So
yeah, I don't know. To hear it. And that is a really difficult part of the conversation, because stress is such a factor. And yet so often people's reaction to that is its own problem. So yes, it is worth considering, is stress a factor in your fertility, ideally with your partner and your doctor, as opposed to everyone else that has a thought, because maybe they're the stress, or if they're not, they may well be exacerbating it, right?
Yeah, and the research shows that stress in itself doesn't affect fertility. And yet there's like a lot of lay theories that that's the case, right? People get pregnant in horrible circumstances, when they're impoverished, when it's a bad abusive situation. So they can't say for sure like, oh, if you're stressed, then you can't get pregnant. However, I think there is something to be said about women's intuition, or like a parent-to-be's intuition of, is this the right scenario for raising a child or not? I could feel that now as I'm pregnant. I could feel that in my body. There are times where I'm really stressed and I feel like, oh, I can't possibly rest. And then, I don't know, the mind-body connection there is a lot stronger. And so for me, I think there is something to be said of not just like stress, oh, do I have a deadline, but of, is this right? Can I be a mother? Is this the right place to parent a child? Start to become a lot more impactful in terms of my decision-making, the way my body was reacting. And apparently that's the way it is in labor and delivery, that if women are scared, it's their labor is more difficult and longer versus if they're relaxed and feel safe. So I don't know, mind-body connection apparently is real.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, that really speaks to the situational stress, as opposed to, oh, that deadline at work is going to stop you having a child. You know, right. Hopefully no one's saying that, but maybe they are. And so, Jacqueline, to bring you back in as well there, I'm interested to know to what extent, if any, people were asking you questions and expecting a certain amount of, you know, information about what were your plans, given that you've taken the step of freezing your eggs, given that you've been public about your fears of your own fertility. And certainly from friends of mine that have gone through similar experiences, that's been one of the trickiest things, that those around them seem to want to be like, okay, what's the strategy? We all need information about this area of medicine in a way that we don't seem to have in certain other things. You know, I certainly notice a contrast there with mental health. Maybe certain questions are asked about fertility that people swing away from with mental health.
I would say, I was never annoyed by anybody asking a question about my plans. Like, when do you want kids, or how many kids do you want? You know, I mean, I was perfectly happy to answer those questions. The most annoying question I got was, why are you doing this? You're so young. And then it's like, well, first of all, I have a fertility issue, you know, like I have a fertility threatening condition. So that's why I'm doing it. But also 30 is not young to freeze your eggs. Because it's actually, you know, if you had to choose when to freeze your eggs, I'd say do it at 25 or 21. Now, obviously, people don't do that because of financial reasons. But the younger you are, the better quality your eggs are going to be. And so that question, it was kind of like you're being dramatic. Why are you doing this? There was some sort of flavor to it like that. And that was frustrating because it is, you know, it's an invalidating of the fact that I was actually making a good decision and, you know, that there was something wrong with me. And so then I would have to talk about that. And that was hard to do while I was really upset at the same time. On the other hand, I understood where it was coming from. It's coming from the lack of education around this topic. So it's not like I blamed people. It was just frustrating to get. And then, you know, the other reactions, like my mom was very concerned about me doing sort of a medical procedure. You know, once she realized there was a fertility threatening condition, she was all for it. But before then it was like, why would you do this unnatural procedure? You're gonna screw something up in your body. And I'm like, no, it's very safe. Like, I need this so that I am not ruled by my bio clock, because that sucks for women. You know, it sucks in terms of choosing a partner, feeling like we are just going to have to kind of settle for whoever's committed. It sucks in terms of career. There's all sorts of things there. And then the third reaction I got that was really bothersome was from my ex-partner, who, when he heard that I wanted to do this, took offense because it was like, oh, well, you're doing this as an insurance policy in case we don't work out. And frankly, part of me was, you know, I'm like, any relationship I'm in, you know.
So they need to be his eggs. That's good to know.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I'm like, yeah, I don't want to choose a relationship based off of my age. I want to choose it based off of the health and enjoyment of the relationship. And so, yeah, if we break up, I want to know that I'm okay. I also want to be able to take my time in a relationship.
Also, is that really what he wants? He wants you to stay with him because you might not have the option of having a child elsewhere. Like, that's so toxic.
This partner, yes.
Yeah. He really showed himself there.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, he became supportive again when there was a fertility threatening condition, because that meant it affected him too. It would affect our chances of pregnancy. But before, when it was my decision, because I just wanted to freeze my eggs and be on my own timeline, it was not very supportive.
And as we start to round up, Kibby, I wanted to touch base with you on the kind of treatment that you were offered, given that we spoke last week off mic about, you know, how much this can vary across the world, including across, you know, the states of the states. Does anyone say it that way? I don't know. I did look up some information into, you know, some examples of this. So in Ireland, something that I actually did not know is that we are the only EU state not to offer publicly funded IVF treatment. And
wow.
I could give you, you know, theories off the top of my head that could relate to that, like, you know, the religious background and still relevance in the country. Our healthcare system in a lot of ways doesn't make sense. This is not the only example. There'll be a whole myriad of reasons there. A stat alone, contrasted with 1 in 6 couples, according to RTE, have difficulty in getting pregnant, and up to half of them will need IVF. So there's that massive contrast there. If you look at the UK, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence recommends 3 cycles of IVF. And how much you actually get depends where you are in the country, depends which health board you're under, because each one decides as part of their budgeting what they can offer. And there's restrictions to do with age and various other things that can vary just depending on where in the country you're trying to get pregnant. And then I also looked more into in the States, and in particular, the most shocking stat I found was that in vitro fertilization on average across the US costs $15,000. And so we can, you know, we can imagine straight away what kind of impact that would have on your insurance premiums. And so could you share a little bit about your experience, if you don't mind, about what was offered to you and what options you felt you had in terms of treatment?
Yeah, I mean, that it's just so sad to hear all those facts and stats. I'm surprised it's as low as $15,000. I thought the average was actually higher, like 20 to 30. Yeah, I think I actually got, well, it wasn't luck. I would say that I was working at Duke University when I first started treatments. And then I actually did, when I was looking for my internship program, which is our last stage of our training, I actually was looking, I knew that I was going to probably need IVF, and I was looking for programs that offered good, you know, coverage for insurance costs. And so it was kind of in the back of my mind, to be honest. And I was lucky that the hospitals that I was working at gave like really good healthcare benefits, and I was able to cover a lot through insurance. I'm in a really fortunate place, though. That is not for everyone. And I feel really sad that that's a big part of the mental health costs in fertility, where not only do you feel like, oh no, there's something wrong with me, but then you don't know if you can actually get the funds to fix it, right? There's like, you know, that is a really prohibitive cost for a lot of people. And for other people, they're, you know, they get pregnant for free and it's no big deal. But for other people, it's like, oh no, I have to basically like go bankrupt if I want to have a child, you know, before the child's even here. And we don't even know if this is going to work, right? There's a lot of uncertainty. You don't know if IVF is going to work. There's three cycles included in a package, but you don't know. So, and that's, you know, that puts, again, a lot of pressure on the woman. Oh my gosh, I have to get the money and I have to make it work, right? And, you know, in the U.S., we have all sorts of stuff, but not only just healthcare costs, but now we have all of these political changes where abortion is going to be a question mark. So there's a lot of things about that, of like where you're living, how rich you are, can you afford this? It feels like a privilege to have a child, and just the cost of it can feel really overwhelming.
Yeah, no, definitely. And particularly with what you said there about recent political changes, it feels like the window can be so narrow between your choices around having or not having a child that mm-hmm. that is so squeezed. And it is not a uniquely American problem, but right now it feels very exacerbated how much money and politics is a factor in what women get to do with their bodies. And so in today's conversation, we've talked a lot about, you know, societal factors in the pressures on women, societal factors in mental health like stigma. And sometimes I wonder about, you know, if we're going too broad with these brushstrokes, or if people will listen and think that I'm blaming everything on, you know, societal mentalities, when, you know, when there are decision makers and there are people that say, you know, specific people that say stigmatizing things that get carried by others. But a lot of this is still very woven into society. And so I really appreciate you both talking it through with me.
This has been great. Yeah.
And if people want to find more of your work, and indeed you also have a brilliant podcast of your own that I'd really recommend, where can they go?
Yeah, so our podcast is called A Little Help for Our Friends. It's a mental health podcast, of course, because we are psychology people, but it's kind of treating mental health as a system, you know, so it's not just the person who's depressed that we're talking about. It might be the mother of that person or a friend who feels helpless when they're trying to help their friend. And so we want to demystify that a little bit, help people understand these disorders and how to help people that they love who are struggling.
I love that.
My Instagram is Trombolina, and that's where we post a lot of our episodes, or a lot of kind of our updates, but our episodes can be found on any podcast streaming service.
Or alittlehelpforourfriends.com is our main website, so you can find everything there.
Brilliant. And I'll include a link to that in the description. I love your work. Thank you again.
Aww.
And we'll wrap up there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.